United States versus Taylor. Mr. Ruth. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Rob Ruth. I'm an attorney representing Mr. Marty Taylor in this appeal, the defendant appellant. The standard of review in this case is de novo. It's a guideline question of law. And there are two principal issues. Either one of the issues answers the question in this case. I think the first issue is whether Begay requires a change in our current case law.
The next issue.
Okay. And that is, our current case law has a definition of the term physical restraint. The conduct in this...
Look, when Isaac was stepping on the teller's back, isn't that physical restraint?
Isaac did not step on the teller's back.
Well, who stepped on her back?
No one. There's no evidence in the record of anyone stepping on the teller's back. Mm-hmm. What it said in the pre-sentence report was that he pushed her down, and I could probably find the exact quote, that he pushed her down and that before he fled. We objected to the pre-sentence report. The video of the robbery was shown at the sentencing hearing, at the evidentiary hearing. The judge made factual findings, and there's no factual finding, and there was no statement by anyone at the evidentiary hearing, and there was no factual finding by the judge that she was pushed down or that her back was stepped
this
down.
This was discussed in the sentencing that he pressed his foot on her back.
No, there's no evidence of pressing a foot on the back.
Was it discussed at the sentencing?
I don't recall it being discussed. I don't ever recall it even being alleged. I don't even recall it being alleged in the pre-sentence report. What we have from the district court in this case is actually taking our case law
one. The judge said Mr. Isaac pressed the gun into the back of the victim's head and pushed her to the ground and pushed the victim in the small of her back to make sure she was on the ground.
No, that's the pre-sentence report, I believe you're reading.
No. I'm not reading the pre-sentence report. I'm reading a sentencing transcript. Page 13 of the appendix at the end of your brief. Think you just made it up?
Well, this is not something that the victim said at the hearing. This is something that's coming from the pre-sentence report that we objected to.
Well, you may have objected to it, but that's what the judge found.
No. Well, but except we're not. She didn't say that he stepped on her.
Oh, come on! I just read it to you. What are you talking about?
And she pushed the small of her back.
Oh, please!
Not that he stepped on her. Not that he held her down.
It's ridiculous. He's lying on the floor. He's got his foot on her back.
No, it doesn't say that he has his foot on her
back.
Well,
how did he get the foot?
It doesn't say that the foot was on the back.
Oh, really?
It says, Mr. Isaac pressed the gun into the back of the victim's head, pushed her to the ground, and pushed the victim in the small of her back to make sure
she was on the ground.
Right, not with his foot.
Now, isn't that a physical restraint?
To make sure
she's on the ground?
That is a physical touching.
That's not a restraint make sure she doesn't get up? Does he have your foot on her back?
It could be physical restraint
unless
you look at our definition of physical restraint.
Would it really matter if it was his foot or his hand or his elbow or his head, whatever it was that, you know, kept her on the ground?
Well, it was a momentary action, number one. Number two, There was no, that she was never tied, bound, or locked
honestly.
Up.
Honestly. Mr. Ruth, let me ask it this way. Do you think somebody who's a victim of an armed robbery like this is in greater danger if she has a pair of handcuffs on her or some duct tape around her wrists or if a gun is pointed to her head?
Definitely having a gun pointed to your head, particularly a loaded gun. I don't dispute that at all. I don't dispute the severely antisocial nature of the behavior. But we have a six-level enhancement for brandishing the gun.
Brandishing.
Right. We already got a six-level enhancement for brandishing the gun. The question here is physical restraint.
Brandishing doesn't require aiming, doesn't require keeping a gun on somebody at all. Right?
Well,
Is that right?
In this particular case, possession to brandishing was because of the pointing of the gun. That's what it said in the pre-sentence report. That's why it recommended brandishing instead of simple possession or use of a gun.
Great, but you can take. I mean, it doesn't take much to qualify for brandishing.
Just having it,
keeping it in your pocket. Keeping your pocket's probably not enough, but displaying it is enough to get the brandishing bump, correct?
I concede that.
Okay. And so is it unreasonable to go a step or two further where you have the explicit terrifying use of the display of the gun by aiming it at one person's head for quite a while to force her to move?
Well, I think that certainly it adds to the terror of the situation. It adds to the aggravating nature of the situation. But that fact does not make it physical restraint.
Why not?
Because we have a specific definition of physical restraint: tied, bound, locked up. And if we confine ourselves,
those are examples.
The examples that were given in the violent felony section of the Armed Career Criminal that was decided in Begay. We have these examples, and they are examples. They're not necessarily exhaustive, but we're supposed to consider those examples when we come to our definition.
But aren't the facts in this case virtually indistinguishable from the ones that were presented in Carter, in which we found that forcing a teller at gunpoint to move from the vault to her drawer constituted a restraint?
They're not, because there's one big difference between this case and Carter. Carter, the gun was pointed at the time of the movement. And in this case, read what the teller said. The gun was, and we went through this, the gun was not pointed at the time of the movement. He pointed the gun at her, she went down, he had her get back up, he had the gun in this hand, and he escorted her with his hand open on the back of her head, not being rough at that point, escorted her to the front room. It's all on video. He escorted her down to the ground.
Back to the podium.
He ransacked the money, stuffed it in the bag. It was a momentary touch to her back, and then he fled. And at that, during none of that, was the gun pointed at her.
You don't say anything about pushing her down to the floor. That doesn't seem to register for you.
Well, because it was such an inconsequential thing, if you look at the video.
Shot to the floor is inconsequential.
If you saw the video, Judge, you would say it wasn't a push. It was a touch.
It was a touch that forces her down onto the floor.
Well, to say that the touch forced her to the floor, I think, is an exaggeration.
One of the most unpersuasive arguments I've ever heard. Look, in Begay, what the court tried to do was figure out what do the enumerated offenses, violent felonies, have in common. And it said, you know, it's violent, aggressive, and so on. So, okay. Now, what is it that the the binding and the, you know, and the gagging or handcuffing, what have you, the enumerated examples for the physical restraint, what do they have in common? That's the critical issue. Well, the obvious thing they have in common is they're preventing the person from moving, right? And if you can prevent a person from moving with some other form, like aiming a gun or shoving or something. Why isn't that within the logic of be gay?
Because what they have in common is that they prevent the person from moving, and that the preventing the person from moving.
Why don't we stop there? Preventing the person from moving, and that's of course what happened to the teller.
There's one more aspect that they have critically in common, though, and that is that the prevention of movement survives after the robber has left. If I point a gun, you're prevented from moving. When I flee.
Wait a second. You mean if the you mean if the robber, having handcuffed the teller after taking the money, removes the handcuffs, you can't have an enhancement for physical restraint?
I think you would, because at that moment...
Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not what I'm saying.
Because that's good.
Handcuffing, locking, tying...
But you just said the difference is that the restraint ended when the robbers left, and you said that wouldn't be the case for handcuffing. So I gave you an example where it is the case for handcuffing, but you say, no, that's still a physical restraint.
Because what you have in the nature of handcuffing, in the nature of tying, in the nature of binding, is a restraint that doesn't require further action by the robber. But what you have...
Why does it matter whether there's further action? What does that mean?
Well, that's the nature of those examples, is that locking the person up, tying the person up, binding the person, is still in place after the robber leaves.
No, we just gave you an example where it's not in place because they remove it when they leave.
Well, you could remove it, but the nature of handcuffing a person is that if you don't do anything more, they're stuck. The nature of pointing a gun is you have to be there constantly pointing the gun.
All right. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ruth. Ms. Altman?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Altman, and I represent the United States here in this case today. The victim in this case was physically restrained, and the enhancement was proper. The conduct in this case falls within this Court's definition of physical restraint, and the ruling in Begay shouldn't and doesn't change that.
Well, what about a case where the robber says, I have a gun, he doesn't brandish it, says, I have a gun, and if you move, I'm going to shoot you. Or suppose he says, I have a gun, but again, he's not brandishing, he's not displaying, but he says, I order you to go to the vault, get money for me, and if you don't, I'll shoot you. Now, is that physical restraint within the meaning of the guidelines?
The first case that you suggested, I would say no. The second case that you proposed, I would say yes.
Well, I don't see the difference.
The first case, I believe, as you suggested, he wasn't telling her or compelling her to do anything. He was...
Was telling her to freeze.
Yes.
Telling her not to move. Well, that's a physical restraint. I mean, if you tell
in
me
a
I can't
sense,
leave
it
this
is.
Room, right, that's physical, that's called, you know, that's false imprisonment.
True.
Right?
In the broadest sense, and it certainly would be false imprisonment. And we were talking about this argument,
well,
that was something we were considering.
Well, then why do you take issue with my first example? I don't understand.
I think it's broader than this case has held, and if this
Why?
Court wants
What's
to expand
What's the principal it, difference, right? You tell the person, freeze, I have a gun, and the person freezes. Now, how is that different from aiming the gun, right, or handcuffing? In any case, you the robber gains his object, which is to make the person not move.
That is true.
So why isn't that the same case?
Perhaps it is.
Well, perhaps it is. If it is, then this is physical restraint is getting pretty broad.
It is. But as you are explaining it, it's...
Well, why wouldn't it be in every robbery? In every robbery, I mean, it's implicit that if, you know, even with a note, go to the teller and says, give me all the money in your drawer. And she says, well, I'm sorry, it's my lunch hour, I'm leaving now.
Right. In that particular case, there's no threats to kill, there's no indication of a weapon.
There's a restraint, because obviously she's afraid to do that if he says he has a gun.
That is true. But this court has...
So what's the line, right? What's the line that prevents every bank robbery from being, or every robbery, period, from being regarded as creating a physical restraint?
Well, this court has said that the line is no alternative but compliance.
Yes, that's satisfied in all these examples, right?
Not necessarily. If it's a note, it's a person could go and pull the trigger as they're opening their door, or pull the alarm, the silent alarm. A person could make a phone call. It might not be smart, but without a gun.
That's not very realistic. If you hand someone a note and say, "I have a gun. So give me money," says to the teller. She says, "Well, okay, after I make this phone call to the police, I'll give you the money." Ridiculous, right?
Yes, I think it is.
So what's the line?
I'm not exactly sure what the line is. Perhaps we'll see the case that it is, but it's not this one. I don't know what the line would be, but I think that having a person approach you with a gun, order you to the ground, bring you back up, take you to another room, all with a gun in their hand, and force you to the ground again and put their foot in your back.
I understand the forcing to the ground. Well, I didn't think you emphasized that particular. I thought you emphasized the gun. Maybe I'm missing something.
I think it's the whole circumstance. We did emphasize the gun. We emphasized the compelled movement. We emphasized the threats. We emphasized all of those things. And I do think, even though we didn't emphasize it, that as you alluded on in Mr. Ruth's argument, pushing her to the ground and putting a foot or a hand or whatever in the small of her back is physical restraint, probably in and of itself, because he is forcing her to do that with a gun in his hand. One of the things I just want to touch on that the defendant put in his reply brief and then he argued again today is taking issue with some of the facts in the PSR. The PSR does say that Mr. Isaac told her that if she did not comply, she would be killed, and then also talks about pushing the small of her back onto the floor to make sure she was on the ground. Now, Mr. Isaac, who did these things, did not object to the PSR. And it is true that Mr. Taylor did object to the PSR, but he didn't object to the facts in the PSR. He only objected to the way they were applied to the guideline and suggested that Begay means that this doesn't matter anymore. And so the idea that these things didn't happen because he objected to the PSR legally just simply isn't true. Those things are still things the court can consider. The government believes that based on everything, the enhancement was appropriate, was properly applied. There was no double counting. To take the examples, the tied, the bound, the locked up, and to apply Mr. Ruth's argument that those are similar because something has to be done to change them, that would preclude someone who is, as noted by the court, or taken to the ground and held there physically, or pressed up against the wall and held there physically with no gun or no rope or no handcuffs or anything, but held there physically during the robbery while someone else takes all the money, then that person gets dropped to the ground and leaves. Using the argument that Mr. Ruth has suggested, that person would not be physically restrained because that person's status changed. And that simply cannot be what this guideline recommends. The United States would respectfully request this court affirm the defendant's sentence. I'm sorry, Judge.
Before you go.
Yes, ma'am.
The court ordered Taylor to participate in the inmate financial responsibility program, but participation in that program is voluntary. And we have held that ordering mandatory participation in that program constitutes plain error. Do you agree that the judgment should be modified to clarify that point? In other words, that participation in the IRFP is voluntary?
I probably should be modified. I mean, the defendant may not object to participating in it, and maybe that's why he didn't make an objection to it, but if that's not something that is allowed, then it certainly should be modified to reflect the voluntary assistance as opposed to the mandatory participation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Altman. Mr. Ruth? have anything further?
If I have any time, I'll be happy to answer your question.
You can have some time.
Okay.
Sure. The answer to your question about where is the line, Your Honor?
No, but just why don't you respond to Judge Rovner? Does your client object to being required to participate in the financial responsibility program?
I haven't asked him. It never came up, and I haven't given it a moment's thought.
That's fine.
So I think as my default would be to object.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Okay. So what do you want to say?
The question is, where is the line? All of the scenarios that you have described, and this scenario, creates restraint. If you point a gun at someone, there's restraint. I don't dispute that. But the difference is, in this statute, the examples of restraint all require the application of a mechanism, and the mechanism is what does the restraining. That's the difference. Pointing a gun is not the application of a mechanism. That's the difference. That's my point in this case.
So locking someone in a teller in the vault, that would be restraint.
Absolutely.
You say you have to have a physical barrier of some sort.
Some mechanism.
So we ought to overrule Carter.
Yes, you should. Now that Begay's come along. Begay tells us how to interpret this rule of statutory interpretation. All of the examples require the application of a mechanism. And that's what physical restraint is. Bad as it is to point a gun, scary as it is, terrifying as it is, it's not physical restraint if you confine yourself to the examples in the guideline.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Reviewer Point, and we thank you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client. We thank Ms. Altman as well. Next.